Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today I talked to John Clark, who is a longtime anti-poverty activist who is gearing up for a new fight against an old enemy with a new face, if you can follow those turn of events. After years of protesting and fighting against the Ontario PC government of Mike Harris in the 90s and early 2000s, Clark, like an anti-poverty superhero, had to come out of retirement for one last mission. Of course, he never really retired, but the fight against poverty has taken on new urgency, and that's where John Clark has always lived. Building a movement to support the most vulnerable is the topic of this edition of the Guelph Politicast. Now, John Clark started his career in anti-poverty activism when he helped found the Union of Unemployed Workers in London, Ontario in 1983. 7 years later, he moved to Toronto and became an organizer with the then newly formed Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. It was 5 years after that, in 1995, that the Common Sense Revolution came to Ontario, and Clark and his colleagues were given a proper adversary. Now, you can Google John Clark's name and read quite easily his history from the days pre-Google, involving bitter protests and demonstrations against the Harris government that quite frequently led to clashes with police and dates in courtrooms. Things calmed down considerably when the Dalton McGuinty Liberals took office in 2003, but the issues of poverty never really went away. Clark and the OCAP went back to doing their best advocacy without so many visits to court, and with a government that at least said the right things in regards to addressing poverty concerns in Ontario. And then Doug Ford came along. In the first 7 months of the Ford government, we've seen the cancellation of the Basic Guaranteed Income pilot, the rollback of previously announced increases to social assistance, the minimum wage increased to $15 was also stopped, and most recently, changes to OSAP have been proposed, turning grants into loans and canceling the 6 month grace period to start paying back student loans. Now, it could be argued that Mike Harris did far worse, but for anti-poverty activists like John Clark, they've seen this movie before, and they know where it's going, or at the very least, they see the direction of the Ford government thus far as heading in the wrong direction. So on this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast, we talk to John Clark, who will soon be in Guelph as part of OPERC's annual Rebel Symposium. Clark will be giving a speech called Building a Movement to Defeat Doug Ford, and as a sort of primer, we'll discuss if he's ready for another fight, how activism and protest strategies have changed since his days fighting Harris, and we'll talk about how the fight against Ford is different from his previous clashes with Mike Harris. We also talk about what Clark wants people to take away from his speech at the symposium, how he's going to try and encourage people to get out of their comfort zones and protest more, and we even talk a little about how best the media should be covering poverty issues. So I caught up with John Clark last week by phone from Toronto. So John Clark, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
I guess I'll start with this question. Are you ready for another fight with another PC government? It's, you know, you've had sort of a 15-year lull in terms of having a sort of a proper adversary. And are you ready to you know, get in the mud again?
Well, I mean, the truth is there's been some fairly incredible struggles during the Liberal period as well, because mm-hmm. Albeit it was with a kinder and a gentler face, the process of introducing austerity and making people poorer was going on. Having said that, there's no question, however, that the Ford government is going to represent an enormous intensification. There's going to be a very sharp struggle. I mean, I suppose in one sense it's a question of having no choice, but on the other hand, I think there's going to be a powerful reaction to Ford, and I think it's going to be in many ways very inspiring and a very exciting time. So, I think personally and the organisation, Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, that I'm part of, I think there's a real eagerness to get into this and make sure that class war is not a one-sided affair.
it seems like the confrontation happened rather quickly. That at least from the mainstream media angle, that a lot of people were at least angling for a change of a face, if not a change of pace, from the Liberals. It seems like Doug Ford has put everybody on their back heel right away. The fight came much sooner, I think, than people had anticipated. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, yes and no. Mm-hmm. I think there's been... unquestionably, there's been a relentless and incredibly sharp attack coming from Ford in terms of attacking the minimum wage, workers' rights, a whole series of brutal austerity measures, the opening at least of a redesign of the social assistance system that's going to impoverish people. Coupled with that, a kind of an approach that sort of wallows in social backwardness, the sex education stuff, and all of these things, and there's been very significant responses. The fight for 15 and fairness didn't just roll over. They took up the fight, even if they weren't able to stop Ford immediately. The fact that nearly 40,000 high school students walked out was incredible. The response that he got from the Francophone communities, I think, absolutely astounded him. But at the same time, I think we'd also have to acknowledge that we're a long way from putting up against him the kind of powerful working class united front of opposition that could really stop him. Mm-hmm. That possibility lies ahead of us. So, what I said about a one-sided class war, at this point, some impressive and inspiring and hopeful initiatives to the contrary notwithstanding, we're still a long way from where we need to be in terms of fighting this man and his government on equal terms.
Mm-hmm. You were making headlines back when Mike Harris was the premier, and I'm wondering, from your observations, what are the differences between the Harris government and the Ford government so far in terms of, I mean, maybe, a lot of the policies seem the same, but in terms of their approaches, in terms of how the policy has been enacted so far, what do you think the difference between them are?
Well, I mean, I think the principal difference that drives external difference that drives any tactical differences in terms of approach is the fact that the austerity agenda has gone so much further than the days when Harris was in power. If we take the issue that we are particularly close to, that of the social assistance system in Ontario, 15 years of sort of shamefaced pseudo-progressive liberal austerity have made people a great deal poorer than they were when they were when Harris was in power. So the great difference is that, I mean, when Harris took the knife to the social infrastructure of the province, there was still some flesh and fat and on the bone, but Ford is going to stick straight into the bone because there's not much left. And I think that's going to be the great overriding difference. I also think that as a political regime, this one is considerably more volatile and contradictory than the Harris Tories. I think they were a much more focused and sort of a disciplined force. Ford riding that sort of wave of right wing populism is to a significant degree the outsider, volatile. Dictatorial. I suspect that the Tory caucus is a seething mass of Byzantine discontent, and as it's challenged, I think that political tension will increase. I think this could well be a regime of crisis. He's already messing up considerably around things like the promotion of his mate to OPP commissioner, or attempt to do so, but if we were dealing with a situation where there was large-scale social mobilization against him, political strikes, people on the streets in massive numbers, I think that that crisis would intensify between the party establishment and the maverick right-wing populist Ford.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you should say that, because one of the things I've been wondering and thinking about is there even an appetite for that anymore? And we see this, I can't remember where I saw it the other day, somebody was talking about this, and at least from the American perspective, is that people have been so ground down that, you know, the mere fact that they have a job is meant to be seen as, you know, sort of winning in society, and the fact you would put it at risk by, you know, being in the streets, being, you know, a quote-unquote agitator. It seems like society has, you know, at least in the last 15 years, has been sort of told, you know, that kind of, you know, social interaction, that kind of social action, civil disobedience, that's not the way to do it anymore.
Well, I mean, I think it can, I mean, there's powerful reasons to conclude that, I think, from looking at the, looking at what is immediately before your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think the missed factor in this is that there is this deep-seated, seething sense of grievance that exists. I mean, to an extent, Ford himself was able to tap into that, in a dishonest and highly contradictory way. But but that mood of discontent, which took the form of punishing the liberals, and to a significant degree buying into his populism, was, I think, an expression of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just a question of Ontario. This is a Canada-wide and indeed an international phenomenon. Perhaps the sharpest expression is the rise of the Yellow Vest movement in France,
mm-hmm.
which people didn't see coming, which is full of contradictions but nonetheless represents this elemental sense of frustration and anger and desire to challenge the austerity agenda that has driven, you know, a much more wily political operator than Doug Ford into a state of crisis.
Right.
So I, you know, yes, the appearance and the immediate reality may be a certain sense of resignation and even passivity, but I think there's an underlying opposite to that that's ready to explode.
Sure, and I think part of that too, though, is that people don't know where to direct their anger, so they get behind somebody like Doug Ford or Donald Trump, and both of whom, you know, I think a lot of comparisons have been made, but, you know, just in terms of the basics, they're both people who have enjoyed incredible privilege, have inherited from successful yep. fathers, but they are seen as working class heroes, and perhaps because they sound more like, you know, Joe on the street versus, you know, Joe in the elite. I just made up that rhyme. I that was not planned.
No, that's right. No. I mean, it's a cheap trick.
Yeah.
it does fool a lot of the people some of the time.
Mm.
But I think it has limited shelf life.
Mm.
The reality is that I think, and again, this is an international phenomenon, we've seen incredible frustration and anger directed against the what is perceived as the political mainstream of neoliberal austerity. In the US, that played out in the form of this massive rejection of Hillary Clinton.
Mm.
Kathleen Wynne was on the receiving end of exactly the same process. But I mean, by definition, the cheap demagogy of somebody like Doug Ford has a very, very limited shelf life.
Mm.
The reality of what he's doing in power and what he's going to do in power, which is essentially to make the rich very much richer at the expense of everybody else and to stick it to the poor, is going to sink home very, very quickly.
Right.
So I think I think his ability to deceive people is a very limited duration, and I think there is going to be a huge explosion of anger against this government, and we're already seeing the first signs of it.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think that anger goes, though? Because people still have, you know, reservations about the NDP. You know, I still see posts in forums and things and in social media, people still talking about Bob Rae like it happened yesterday. And, you know, the Liberals show no signs of getting their house in order. It seems like I come back to this idea that, you know, the anger out there, it exists, it's real, but it's very undirected. So it kind of gets swept up by the loudest voice in the room. And right now that's Doug Ford.
Right. Yeah. Well, where it goes electorally, I mean, remains to be seen. I mean, the truth is that in the last election, the NDP did, to a significant degree, move to the left. Mm-hmm. And the response was actually quite remarkable in terms of the growth of support. It didn't prove to be enough to stop Ford, but it was still a very significant growth. And you have to ask yourself if, rather than this being really a sort of an electoral tactic, if the NDP consistently over a period of years had used its political base as a sort of a hub for community organizing, had consistently advanced policies that broke with the austerity agenda and posed a real serious left alternative, the electoral outcome might have been very, very different. Certainly in the UK, the rise of Jeremy Corbyn, I think, has expressed that very clearly. But whether it's electorally or not, the alternative to right-wing populism is not to be found in the neoliberal mainstream, is not to be found within an austerity consensus. It's to be found in a distinct left break with that. And that's going to have to, that may well and probably should have a very definite electoral component to it, but it's also going to have a social mobilization component to it too. We're not going to sit around for 4 years and get beaten up by Doug Ford and then hope for some electoral miracle. We've got to actually engage and stop the implementation of this agenda here and now.
I'm wondering, what do you think drives Doug Ford? Because he's certainly someone who, when in his city councilor days, kind of really showed not much interest in the day-to-day business of council. He wasn't a policy wonk. He wasn't, you know, his one sort of substantive piece of planning and proposal was kind of laughed. I remember the day, because I was in Toronto that day, that he came out with the waterfront plan. That kind of got laughed off immediately. So, you know, he rises up in provincial politics, goes from zero to premier in about 6 months and immediately starts enacting this agenda. What do you think his end goal is? Like, where do you think he sees himself in 4 years?
I really think that the pathetically crude slogan that the Tories are using, Ontario is open for business, I think really does quite succinctly express the political agenda that Ford is genuinely very devoted to. I think he wants to remove all barriers that stand in the way of profit making and super exploitation. I think he despises environmental regulations, consumer protections, worker rights, all measures that place limits on the ability of capital to exploit. And as much as possible, he wants to dismantle all those regulations, all those elements of the social infrastructure that have, to a degree, equalized things. He wants to reverse those things. So, I mean, and he's here at the right time, because the agenda that he's implementing is in line with the main thrust of the whole international neoliberal agenda. People hoped after the Great Recession 10 years ago that there would be a new golden age of Keynesianism, but that hasn't happened. There's been a doubling down on austerity, and Ford is a gladiator in that regard. So I think that we're dealing with a situation where, from being a sort of a relatively measured, plodding, incremental implementation of that agenda in Ontario under the Liberals, we're now going to a situation where Ford emerges as one of the sort of the leaders of the international pack. So Ontario becomes now a place where we're going to create in the next few years a model of effective resistance, or a model of a model of dismal failure. But one way or another, Ontario is going to be a bit of a cutting edge jurisdiction in the next little while.
What about the PC caucus? Because before Doug Ford, there was Patrick Brown, and he had a very different message and a very different, or at least on the surface, agenda. That it seems that the caucus, you know, switched maybe not 180 degrees, but went from, you know, 10 degrees to 100 degrees in sort of the blink of an eye. What are they thinking, do you think?
Well, I imagine there's a strong sense that I would suspect that Doug and his immediate entourage run a pretty tight ship. I would imagine that the discontent and disaffection is not tolerated, but I would imagine that there are lots of disagreements, and as long as he has momentum and he's in a strong position, it's very likely that there's not going to be significant opposition to him, and anyone who does raise their head is going to be made an example of. But under different circumstances, that opposition could become much more significant. A really seriously divided cabinet and caucus becomes a real possibility. I mean, it's a pretty open secret that the establishment of the party didn't exactly favour Doug Ford, that his support came more from the snarly reactionary base of the party. Mm-hmm. And those contradictions are there, and they're going to play out. And how they play out has a lot to do with what we do, we as a movement of opposition.
Mm. Christopher Curry, who's a staff member at CFRU here, he said on election night, when we were doing live coverage on election night, he didn't think Doug Ford would make it to the end of 4 years as the leader of the PCs. What do you think?
I think that's... I wouldn't make that as a confident prediction, but I certainly think it remains a very definite and a very strong possibility. Under conditions of crisis, the dumping of Doug Ford and the attempt to put in place a more, sober and measured and more, a leader that would pursue the essential elements of the Ford agenda, but tread more carefully. I think that's a real. That's a real possibility. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what, I mean, we have the, if we were able to build a movement of opposition that was sufficiently strong, that created real political crisis for this government, we might pose the possibility of something more ambitious than just defeating Doug or a shuffle at the top. We might actually challenge this government in a more fundamental way.
Well, you are coming to Guelph in a couple of weeks to help sort of rally the cause. You're talking at the Rebel Symposium that OPERC's putting on. Your speech is called "Building a Movement to Defeat Doug Ford," and I wanted to start specifically with this question in terms of, again, you've been at this a while. How has, you know, the art of protest changed in the last, 20 years, back from, when you were out there protesting Harris? There was no social media, there was no, the internet was, not as pervasive as it is now. Yes. How has that changed the game?
Well, I mean, the basis on which people can communicate and organize has indeed been revolutionized by social media. And that's not a small question, and it's not just there remains this pervasive notion of a privileged set having access, but all of the explosive, even in very impoverished countries, mobilizations that are taking place are relying to a huge degree on social media, and the ability to not just mobilize an event but communicate what's going on during an event and all these kinds of things are heavily influenced by social media. That's very important. But social media, as significant as it is no substitute for actually mobilizing those people and taking those actions. And I think, as in the days of Harris, what what the challenge before us is to recognize that sort of moral pressure and forms of mobilization that are primarily about trying to register a case in the hope that the government is listening, that's a hopeless proposition. If we're going to mobilize, we have to be prepared to and able to inflict a level of economic disruption and political disruption on this government that actually challenges its ability to proceed. Mm-hmm. And they're a pretty bloodthirsty and determined bunch. They're not going to be squeamish. They're not going to back off just because they think a lot of people don't like them.
Well, they also have a social media campaign of their own that is quite successful.
Yeah. They do indeed. They do indeed. They're determined. They have the backing of the rich and powerful, and they have a significant social base, and we shouldn't forget that. So a fight against them is going to be a serious proposition, and the movement that we have, there's a lot of very rapid and very serious building that needs to be done. So we have big challenges, but I think we also have big possibilities. Mm-hmm. In the end, there's a lot more of us than there are of them, and what they're doing to us is intolerable, and with that combination, I think we can build something to stop them.
So what's the message you're going to be sending to the people who attend the symposium? You know, what do you hope that they leave with?
Well, I mean, I think we are in the period now where we're trying to assemble the basis for a movement that can actually effectively resist. Mm. And that involves a huge amount of work. It isn't just an organizational question. We can't be going around having sort of boring, plodding meetings about organizational forms. We've got to actually start fighting. People are fighting, but we've got to fight on a bigger scale very soon. But I think we have to set ourselves a goal of, you know, still at rallies, all I hear people say is, you know, the next 4 years of Doug Ford. The first thing we have to recognize is we're not reconciled to 4 years of Doug Ford.
Right.
We're trying to stop this man. We're trying to defeat his government. But then we have to pose the question of how far we are away from the capacity to do that. Mm. and how much we have to change and galvanize and rejuvenate the movements that we have, community movements, but including and especially trade unions. There has to be a really different approach taken. And we're not there, and we need to get there.
Do you think there's still a big role for unions? I mean, not to cast aspersions on the unions themselves, but I mean, their power is being chipped away. It's being whittled down, and you know, I think the biggest labor unions left are the ones that are representing public employees, and unfortunately, they can be marginalized fairly quickly just under the talking point that they're in it to protect their jobs. So, you know, can the labor union still be that big a force?
Oh, I mean, despite the fact that there's been a huge process of deindustrialization in this province, despite the fact that public sector unions have been under attack, there is still, I think, an enormous potential power in the trade unions, but it has to be expressed, I think, as part of a broad movement that goes beyond the membership of the trade unions and reaches down into communities as well. I was just reading something about the teacher strike that's taking place in Los Angeles right now, where there's been a really powerful mobilization, but it has taken place on the basis of the teachers very clearly articulating the position that, yes, they're fighting for their rights as workers, but they're also fighting for public education.
Right.
And I think that's the kind of approach that has to be taken. The Canadian Union of Postal Workers, locked in a struggle with Canada Post, has gone on the offensive and talked about how the post office could serve communities and serve progressive agendas. And so I think there has to be imaginative thinking, and there has to be changed tactics and different approaches. But I think the concept of a working class united front of unions and communities under attack is still very much a winning proposition if it's pursued seriously.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the current Ontario government is persuadable? And one of the things I'm thinking of is there's been enormous negative reaction to Bill 66. Here in Guelph, the city council voted unanimously to send a letter saying, don't, you know, please don't pass this as it is. Kitchener and Waterloo and Cambridge, I think, followed suit. The Burlington and Hamilton mayors came out very early against it. Do you think that, I mean, Guelph has obviously the only green MPP, but, you know, some of these places do have conservative MPPs. Do you think they're listening to, you know, the people who are running the cities they're representing? And do you think that it's persuadable that, you know, for putting aside that in, you know, 3.5 years, we're going to be out there trying to defeat the Doug Ford government. Do you think that, you know, maybe minds can be changed in the meantime?
Well, I mean, I think that sort of point brings home what I was trying to put across is in the sense that, I mean, yeah, Ford is not particularly concerned about the notion that lots of people don't like him or oppose him. And I don't think he's obsessed with what the opinion polls say. Mm. And when it comes to the municipal level of government, I mean, the slashing of Toronto City Council, for example, what was striking about that was that some fairly powerful and significant people were mobilizing against him, and he didn't really care, ready to use the notwithstanding clause and what right. have you. I mean, he sees the municipal level of government as a base of potential opposition that he wants to crush and ensure is mainly run by bureaucrats and is just prepared to rubber stamp the agenda of austerity. The opposition that is mobilized against him can't just simply be one that registers a differing point of view. It has to mobilize in ways that actually create for him a real problem. Mm. And that must involve, I think, the political strike. It must involve forms of social mobilization that are really intensely disruptive. And we have to become a threat. Doug Ford will put up with a nuisance. We have to become a real threat if we're going to stop him.
Right. You are one of the experts on this topic in terms of ways to combat poverty in the province. And I wanted to ask you, I'll head you on the line. One of the things I've been struggling with as nascent media, upstart media, is, you know, how do we cover poverty other than just the, you know, there's a food bank drive happening, or there's a clothing drive happening, or, you know, the daily crime blotter and these things that sort of speak to the issue of poverty, but don't really get to really giving it proper coverage. So from your point of view as an activist, what do you think we in the media can do to cover poverty better?
Well, I mean, I think there is already, and it's going to get much worse under Ford, there is a very definite humanitarian crisis that's created in terms of hunger and homelessness and exploding food bank use and all these things. And it's very real, and it certainly should be highlighted. Mm. But I think the fundamental problem that exists is that poverty and the poor are simply relegated to that issue of sort of human interest story. Mm. Whereas I think people need to understand that the war on the poor is actually connected to the broader austerity agenda. Mm. When they drive people down to levels of below subsistence when they live on when they're on social assistance, I mean the function of that. And Ford articulates it more clearly than anybody. His minister says the best social program is a job.
Right.
I mean, what they're really seeking to do is to drive people into the low-wage sector. And in doing so, drive down wages generally.
Mm.
You know, I mean, the effects of this have been remarkable. Before we can get to Ford, I mean, in 97, one worker in 40 was working for the minimum wage in Ontario. By 2015, it had become one worker in 8. And without the driving down of income support systems and the proliferation of poverty, it wouldn't have been possible to do that. So I think, you know, working class people who work for a living and are waged workers, all have a common interest in fighting back against poverty. Mm. So, you know, when we mobilize the poor, we do so as part of a broad working class alliance. And
right.
that's something that I think people need to understand. And media, at least progressive media, needs to help drive that home. I don't place much hopes on the mainstream media, nonetheless, that's the central question.
It makes me think that, And I was reading this this quote from you that your concern about the basic guaranteed income pilot was that it wasn't a pilot program to lift people up. It was a pilot program for big companies to subsidize their workforce. So if I'm hearing you correctly, and by all means correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe the focus should be on not the people in poverty themselves, but on the things that government and business are doing to sort of keep people poor and create, as you said, more poor.
Yes, I mean, our whole problem with the basic income approach, and though I must sheepishly admit that Doug Ford, from a vastly different perspective, is also an opponent of basic income. but the whole problem is that there's this notion that, you know, low wage, precarious work is just an inevitability, and all we can do is hope to come up with a social policy, you know, sort of Valium to make it feel better. Mm. But instead, I think the fight is for workers' rights. The fight is for living wages. The fight, the answer is not to provide a de facto subsidy to low wage employers, but to demand that low wage employers pay living wages, decent wages. Mm. And that's the key struggle. But that doesn't happen just because I sit here on the phone and say it should happen. It's going to have to happen because a movement fights for it.
Right. Maybe to wrap up, I read something you wrote where you were describing you were heading to Michigan for a speaking engagement, and you were at the border crossing for quite some time as they sort of questioned you rather maliciously, it sounded like. And I'm wondering, are you still harassed by the police? And you know, when you're traveling and or even just when you're you know, out doing activism, that, you know, they know who they know you, they know your face, they know your name, and they know your trouble, and so they're going to bother you?
Well, I mean, you know, at the events and actions we organize, they're always fairly heavily policed, and the police certainly know who we are and all the rest of it. And something like trying to get across a border can be an issue or something like that. But no, in my day-to-day life, I'm not facing, you know, I'm sure there's an element of scrutiny, but I don't sort of have, you know, I don't sort of have a tail on me that I'm aware of, or, you know, and they're not stopping me on the street relentlessly or anything like that. No, I mean, it was a bit more tense at different periods when there were, you know, outstanding legal complications and what have you. And possibly this is a period under Ford where that stuff is more likely to happen again. But in any event, I mean, you know, we don't necessarily have to focus on that. If we have those legal problems, it's part of building a movement. We just work around it.
But so far as you know, there's nobody at Border Patrol carrying a big file folder with your clippings in it anymore.
Well, you should have seen the file folder that this particular character you're talking about brought up from Detroit. It was a pretty impressive folder, so I doubt they've thrown it away.
Well, John, keep fighting the good fight, and we look forward to seeing you here in Guelph. Thanks for talking to me today.
Thanks a million.
And once again, that was John Clark, and you'll be able to hear John Clark in person and see him too when he gives the keynote address, Building a Movement to Defeat Doug Ford, at OPERG's Rebel Symposium on Saturday, February 9 at 12 p.m. in room 442 of the University Center. The Rebel Symposium is a 3-day event at the University of Guelph on February 8, 9, and 10, and you can find out more at symposium.operguelph.org. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics. It's Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to Guelph Politico on Facebook at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate.
And for all the latest local political news, check out GuelphPolitico.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you very shortly. And until then, see you next time.